Before we start, a quick heads up. Today's show includes stories of sexual assault that could be triggering for some listeners. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. When Dr. Christine Blasey Ford described her alleged sexual assault before Congress on Thursday, women across the country and the world were listening. They were also talking. Blasey Ford's testimony brought to the surface difficult memories, and sexual assault survivors who never shared publicly what happened to them started doing so, at home, on social media, and at workplaces, including ours. Most of 1A's production team is female, and most of them identify as sexual assault survivors. One producer described her assault as a clear abuse of power. She says, at a previous job, I had a mentor.
He got me to go to his house on the pretense that I was getting instructions before watching his cat. Then he got me drunk, kissed me, and put his hand on my chest.
Another producer said her assailant was well known to her. She told us it was after a night of drinking
in high school by an ex-boyfriend. I said no over and over, but eventually just let it happen. I remember kind of retreating into myself and focusing
on a corner of the ceiling. Like Christine Blasey Ford, the women on our staff sometimes fixated on unexpected details. One said, the lights of passing cars are what I remember.
Plus feeling so exposed and scared as they shone through the window of the car we were doing it in. It hurt so badly, and I burst into tears immediately after.
Here's what another producer had to say. He was a guy I had a crush on.
I remember flashes of images, him pulling down my shorts and underwear, his hands on my chest, and I remember that I couldn't move.
And one last account from our team. It was in eighth grade
when I was sexually assaulted at school by another student. I told the dean of the middle school, but no action was taken. I saw my attacker almost every day until he moved away a few years later.
Hearing these stories is like a gut punch. I never would have imagined that so many of my colleagues were directly affected by assault and harassment, let alone most of them. I am furious and frustrated that I can't do anything to erase what they've been through. These brilliant, funny, driven, skilled women who do way more to make 1A happen than I ever have or will. But perhaps that fury and frustration are naive. Perhaps I should have assumed that at least some of them had been through it. And perhaps you have too. Today we'll explore this moment of reckoning, not just for the Supreme Court and partisan politics, but how breaking the silence could change our society and our culture. Joining us from Harvard University is Kerestin Conan, a professor of psychiatric epidemiology. She studies the health effects of sexual assault trauma, and she testified before Congress about her experience of sexual assault while she was in the Peace Corps. Professor Conan, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us here in our studio is Lauren Taylor, the founder and director of Defend Yourself, which teaches sexual violence prevention. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
Lauren Taylor, let me start with you. There's been, as we mentioned, this outpouring of stories from people in workplaces like ours to celebrities like Padma Lakshmi from Top Chef, Jodie Sweetin, who came to fame in Full House. What's happening here?
I think we really are in a cultural shift where, although there's still a lot of victim blaming and pushback and not believing of survivors, there is also more space for people to tell their stories than ever before. And once anybody tells what happened to them, there's a ripple effect. And even you see the difference between what happened a year ago when Harvey Weinstein and Tarana Burke's Me Too movement took bloom. Now it's 1 year later, and with Christine Blasey Ford telling her experience, it's not just Me Too, but it's actually sharing of stories. And I think that there's more space than ever before to get support, even though there's still a lot of resistance and pushback. We're seeing literally writing in the sky that says, we have your back. We're seeing constant. It used to be that if there was something about survivors in the news, it was once every 3 months. And right. Now it's multiple stories a day. And I just feel like people have more space and there's a lot more. They know that they're not alone. So it's So they're taking that risk.
Professor Conan, before we talk about some of your work researching the long-term impact of sexual assault, I want to get into a bit of what this conversation has meant for you. As I understand it, in the last few days, your sister and her friends kind of reframed some of their memories from the past. Get into that a bit, if you would.
Sure. So one of the things that struck me is the Dr. Ford's testimony has led a lot of us to revisit our own experiences in high school and college. And my sister told me about a long text she had with her college friends, where in the text, they were talking about how when they were in college and went to frat parties, they knew not to go to the bathroom during the party, because if you went to the bathroom during the party, you'd be assaulted. And she gave examples of friends who had gone to the bathroom during the party and where this had happened. And what was so striking to her now, my sister's in her 40s, is that they accepted that. She and her friends just accepted that in college as the norm. And that's sort of scared her, made her sad. And also all of us have children today and thought, you know, that's not the norm we would want for our own kids. And that's the reframing that's going on, is not just remembering, but also reexamining old experiences and questioning the fact that we, as women, we accepted feeling unsafe, that was okay. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that anyone reported to anyone. And that's really struck me as well.
Let me get to a clip from Professor Ford's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday, where she described some of the long-term effects of her alleged assault. Listen.
Well, I think that the sequelae of sexual assault varies by person. So for me personally, anxiety, phobia, and PTSD-like symptoms are the types of things that I've been coping with. So more specifically, claustrophobia, panic, and that type of thing.
And just to clarify, sequelae are conditions that are the consequence of a previous disease, a previous injury, after effects, basically. Now, those feelings that Professor Ford described were familiar to many of you, many, many, many of you who called us with your own stories. We've just been inundated. Here is some of what you left in our inbox.
Watching Mrs. Blasey Ford testify was extremely powerful for me as a survivor of sexual assault. My heart goes out to her, and I am so grateful for her bravery. However, I did not stop to think before viewing that it would cause me to have flashbacks of the one memory that stands out the most in my mind of my assault. The flashbacks and the PTSD are the hardest to deal with.
Even though I have suffered because of this for many years, I've never wanted to come forward. And this week has been a lot of reflecting for me, and I'm angry.
When is society going to stop putting the reputation and future of male attackers over the dignity and future of the women and men they attack? Because 15 years later, I still felt like I was drowning listening to those hearings.
This has brought up a lot of anxiety, fear, anger, frustration, hypervigilance again. I thought I was over that. And I just can only imagine how it's affecting other women in this country who are survivors.
Thanks very much to all of you who shared your stories with us. We'll get to more of your stories in a moment. But Lauren Taylor, many folks who wrote to us or contacted us said that Professor Ford's testimony was triggering. Give me some thoughts on what folks who have felt triggered by all of this might do.
To take care of themselves?
Yeah, to take care of themselves, to deal with that sense of being triggered.
So hopefully most survivors know what works for them. There's a range of things. In the moment, the most important thing to do is know that you are here now and not back when it happened. So that can take the form of feeling your feet on the floor, feeling the water as you drink it, or just looking at the room around you and noticing, oh, this is blue, oh, this is textured, and putting yourself in the current moment. And then people have tons of other strategies, whether it's, you know, yelling into a pillow or petting the dog or gardening so that you feel the earth. Most survivors, in my experience, know what helps them. And and it can be very individual, and that's the best thing to go to.
Interesting strategy, kind of grounding yourself in the present and exactly. articulating that. I know we have to pause in just a moment, but Professor Conan, at what point is it accurate or helpful to refer to these symptoms as PTSD?
First of all, the reacting to this testimony is normal. It's normal to have to be upset and have a response. But if this, the things these women are describing, anxiety, insomnia, being really hypervigilant, if it's lasting for weeks and it starts interfering with your life, like you can't go to work, you're having trouble, you know, you're losing it at your kids, you start avoiding things that normally that you like to do. And if that persists, then I would say it's more into a PTSD, a more diagnostic, you know, situation where then I would say you need to perhaps get help, therapy, if you have one, can be, you know, really helpful. And PTSD can be treated effectively, and you can recover from it. I have myself. I've treated people for it. But that's really something, if it's starting to persist with your functioning, it's lasting for, you know, into weeks and months.
We'll continue this conversation with Professor Kirsten Conan and Lauren Taylor in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Grow with Google. Digital skills are becoming more and more important in today's economy. That's why Grow with Google is providing free online training and tools to help Americans learn the skills they need to succeed. Learn more about Grow with Google and get started by visiting google.com/grow.
On the latest Planet Money, a special report inside the business of asylum. We go inside an underground network of professional story writers, coaches, and scammers gaming the asylum system, and how the FBI cracked down. That's on the latest Planet Money.
Let's add another voice to the discussion. Joining us from NPR in New York is Mara Gay, a member of the New York Times' editorial board. Mara, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, on Saturday, you wrote in the Times an account of your assault and its emotional aftermath. In part, you wrote, quote, "I never felt compelled to share my story before because it is so unremarkable, so common, because so many women have been through worse," unquote. Unremarkable? What made you think of what you had been through as unremarkable, and what changed your mind?
You know, for years, my friends and I have been, and colleagues as well, just sharing stories, swapping stories, you know, in bars, on trips abroad of our sexual assaults, of our sexual harassment, and just knowing how many of my friends have been through similar experiences somewhere on that spectrum. I just, you know, as a journalist too, I never want to make it about me. And so my instinct is to tell other people's stories. And hearing from some of my friends and colleagues during Dr. Ford's testimony, though, getting text messages about the kind of pain that they were in, the PTSD, it made me rethink my decision to stay silent about my own experience.
Can you share with us, to whatever extent you feel comfortable, what happened to you?
Sure. So it was over a decade ago. I was in college and, you know, I was at a party with a boy who I had kind of had a crush on, I guess, for a long time. I think we both had been interested in one another and we drank a lot. I was, you know, 20 years old at the time and he drank more than I did. One thing led to another and we ended up back at his place and we were having sex. And that sex was consensual, although I would say that it was rougher, frankly, than I would have expected. It kind of took me by surprise. And, you know, suddenly, all of a sudden, we were actually having anal sex, which I had not consented to. And it was very painful. And I asked him to stop, and he eventually did. I mean, it felt like a lot longer for me at the time, but frankly, you know, I think, frankly, he was probably too drunk to kind of know what was going on, is what I thought at the time. And, you know, afterwards, I dated him. And I think now I know that that's a very common experience. But, you know, at the time, there was no nationwide conversation about these things. So, you really didn't realize how common that is. And so I think I felt so much shame in what had happened that I just, you know, stayed silent about it until a couple of years later when I started talking to some friends and, you know, kind of realizing, owning that experience for what it was, which is really what helped me move on.
Now, last week, Professor Conan, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont asked Professor Ford what her strongest memory was of what she accuses Judge Brett Kavanaugh of having done to her as a teenager. Here is part of what Professor Ford said.
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter, the uproarious laughter between the two and they're having fun at my expense.
Professor, can you explain for us from a neurological perspective why it is that certain aspects of assault stand out in people's memories, perhaps by way of explaining what the hippocampus is and what it does?
The hippocampus is a part of the brain involved in memory. And Dr. Ford, in her testimony, talks about being afraid she's going to die or that he's going to kill her. And the human brain has specific parts that are evolved to encode fear. And if you just think about it, that's because fear, especially in prehistoric times, kept us alive. You don't want to see a lion and have to think, oh, is that dangerous or not? Should I run away? When people who can encode that fear of that lion and immediately react will escape and survive. So similarly, in fear memories, like a memory of an assault, the brain becomes hyper-focused on specific details. So it's really common to remember perhaps the color of the person's eyes or a sound or the music or, like Dr. Ford says, the laughter, because that even just hearing her talk about it really makes my heart clutch. You know, it's really emotional. But forget other details like the house you were in or the neighborhood or the street. Those are irrelevant in the moment the assault is happening. So I hope that sort of helps explain it. But it is the way the brain operates.
It kind of feels like when the way she described it, the way you described it, it feels like that experience you have when you're like watching a scary movie or walking through a haunted house. You'll forget all the decor, but that thing that leaped out at you that kind of forced your adrenaline to rise, that's what encodes.
Great example, yes.
Now, Mara, you've said that Lauren, I beg your pardon, Lauren Taylor, these moments that encode so intensely, are there ways to weaken the power of them in the mind, or do you just kind of have to deal with them? Those things that kind of trigger, those images that are super vivid, how do you work through those, or can you?
There are many, many ways to work through those. Talking about it and getting support, whether that's a therapist, community support group, or an informal group of friends can be, and getting validation, talking to the right people can be incredibly helpful. What we do in our empowerment self-defense classes is help people find their voice and find their physical power. Talk therapy can accomplish a certain amount, but as Professor Conan will tell you, the trauma also lives in the cells of your body, and you need to have some kind of somatic release of that. And somatic basically means soma is body. So we do role plays of practicing standing up for yourself or asking for what you want, and we also do hitting. And that can really move the trauma through and out your body. You're not only reclaiming your power, but you're also releasing whatever you've been through.
Let me get to a few more of your stories. Jennifer emailed, "My story involves a sexual predator who happened to be my boss. Ultimately, I was raped on a business trip. To get away, I had to move to another state and begin my career again. The cascade of consequences for each woman like me goes on for decades." Kiki emailed, "I'm 72. I told my best friend about her employee who sexually harassed me. He asked me to show him my breasts while he stroked himself. Asked disgusting questions. You did not tell in my day. My friend, she laughed. My friend, she's not my friend any longer." Mara, you said that one moment that stood out to you from last week's testimony had to do with Professor Ford running into the person that she says witnessed the alleged assault. I'd like you to react to it as soon as we play a little piece.
Mark Judge looked like he was working there, and arranging the shopping carts. And I said hello to him. And his face was white and very uncomfortable saying hello back.
Mara, why did that stand out for you?
Well, you know, I actually ran into the boy I dated who raped me several months ago in my favorite bar. And I happened to be actually with a man I was dating at the time who's a very dear friend of mine, who I feel very safe with to this day. And I froze like a, almost like prey, like they talk about, you know, deer freezing in the woods. And my reaction was to be so polite, you know, which is really, I think, a defense mechanism, you know, something that's available to us as women, just to get out of that situation as quickly as possible. And afterwards, my friend who I was with, when I told him who that was we had just run into, and actually the guy had come up to me, gave me a kiss on the cheek, gave me a hug. We hadn't seen each other in 10 years.
This is the guy who assaulted you?
Yes, yes. And so I was in shock. And after they left, you know, he and his brother left. And when they did, I turned to my friend and I said, you know, that's the boy who raped me. And my friend, you know, ran out the door ostensibly in the moment. He was very angry. He was going to confront them. And I was able to stop him. And, you know, my friend's response was really jarring because it really made me rethink about my own, you know, my own response or non-response. And why wasn't I that angry? And this happened to me. You know, I think as women, we tend to want to be people pleasers and make everyone else around us feel comfortable and not make us seen. Even on our own behalf, even when we are entitled to a real amount of rage. And you know, you can't help but feel that way watching Dr. Ford testify so composed about what had happened to her.
Yeah.
And you contrast that with the anger of her alleged assailant. And I just think the experience of just the daily indignities that we go through,
right.
You know, having to, you know, be polite to someone who is your assailant. I mean, I think I hit a breaking point watching her do that and others do that. And I just don't want to do that anymore.
I do want to give out a hotline number, by the way, if this news cycle or this conversation is kind of triggering for you, it's bringing up some traumatic memories and you need someone to talk to, or if you need some help. Here is the number for the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Here it is, 800-656-4673. Again, 800-656-4673. Let's get to another one of your stories before we keep going. Gio emailed, "I am a 47-year-old survivor of sex trafficking. I was brought into this country when I was 14 years old from South America by a U.S. tourist. I was too young to realize back then that my life was going to turn into physical and sexual exploitation. 2 years ago, the thoughts I buried so deep resurfaced so vividly that thoughts of killing myself were constant. I recently got helped with therapy and medication, but what happened last week during the court hearings hurt so much as we survivors are being put down as crazy and irrational." Lauren, I see you nodding. I would love to get your thoughts on what the Kavanaugh hearings will mean for survivors. Let me get to a few more comments about that because we've gotten several to that effect. Kat tweeted, "As a survivor, the hardest part of the debate over the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh has been the mocking, attacking, and dismissive remarks made by friends and family. Even as I have shared my story, I have been dismissed as being emotional." And another listener texted, "I'm a psychologist seeing clients for therapy. Between Wednesday and Thursday, I heard two people's sexual assault stories for the first time, along with their beliefs that no one would believe them if they told. I also had a client return to something we had talked about a year ago, a domestic violence incident which her estranged, abusive husband was able to convince a court was her fault. I'm convinced that if Kavanaugh is confirmed now, it will have a chilling effect on women's trying to charge men with sexual and physical assaults." Lauren?
This is a really important part of the conversation. So as a survivor myself, I had a really hard time when Clarence Thomas was approved, whatever the word is.
Confirmed, right.
Confirmed, right. Because I felt like it was all the people in power saying to all the survivors, we don't believe you and you don't matter. Because of that and the memories of that, which I do feel in my body, that moment when the yes vote went through, I did not watch Christine Blasey Ford's and Brett Kavanaugh's testimony. I just felt too unbearable to me. I do think that assuming that he gets confirmed, it will be different. Not that it isn't the people in power saying, we don't believe you and you don't matter. There is still that. And it will still feel that powerful to many, many survivors. At the same time, now we're hearing hundreds of people saying, me too, I share your story. This happened to me. Mine was slightly different. And I'm with you. And people saying, I have your back. I believe you. So I think the cultural context, while we have a long way to go, has really shifted. And that progress won't be taken away.
Professor Conan, I know we have to pause momentarily, but what do you think about the possible effects on survivors of the Kavanaugh confirmation process before we have to break?
I'm hoping that the effects are, you know, in the long term, positive, that this public conversation, as the other guests have said, helps people to feel that they're not alone, and that at least some people have their back, as even if, again, even if he gets confirmed. I've also seen there's been a lot of public evidence of men coming out in support and powerful men and women and shows like this one. So I'm hoping that in the longer term it will be positive for sexual assault survivors generally, and there'll be a sea change that we'll see that will have ripple effects down the line.
I would love to get your sense of the role that men play in this Me Too movement, particularly men who have been the offenders. Jaime tweeted, a male perspective is needed to move the needle. Other men need to hear from men who have been the perpetrator and why they did it. I think some men can't get why a guy would do this to begin with and need to understand that part in order to believe the women more. What role should men be playing in this Me Too moment? We'll try to get some answers to that and more in just a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the next How I Built This, how Sandy Lerner helped launch one of the most successful tech companies in the world, Cisco Systems, why she had to leave it, and how she went on to remake herself again and again and again. You can find How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.
We got many messages in our inbox, as I said. Here's one more that came into us.
My name is Lib, and I'm calling from Central Virginia. 42 years ago, I was raped by my brother, and it was only last year that I was able to acknowledge that and begin dealing with the fallout from it. I keep hearing people say, well, why on earth would she wait 36 years if it had really happened? It must be a lie. And I can tell you exactly why. It doesn't matter that we're victims. When we are raped, we feel wrong. We feel shame and humiliation and embarrassment, and we don't want to admit it to ourselves, let alone to anyone else. If it was not a violent rape that left obvious marks, it's easy to pretend it never happened. And emotionally, it feels like the right thing to do because you're so scared and so hurt and so ashamed.
Lib, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Mara Gay, I'd love to get your reaction to that story, particularly the shame, the humiliation, the embarrassment that comes after an incident like that, after an attack like that.
Wow. It's powerful. Yeah. So I spent many years in therapy, and not necessarily, certainly not just because of my assault. It was one of the things of many that I dealt with. But I have been so struck by the number of friends and colleagues and acquaintances who have reached out to me after I shared my story, you know, sharing things they haven't told anyone before. I was molested. I was raped. It goes on and on and on. And I really am also a huge fan of Brené Brown, who's a social researcher who studies shame and vulnerability, right? And I've become a huge believer that shame needs secrecy to survive. And a huge part of the reason that I decided to share my story is selfish. It's because I don't believe anymore that this shame that I've been carrying around should have ever been my own shame. And so in telling my story, I feel a huge sense of relief. I was able to discharge that into the public arena where I believe it belongs, and no longer hold on to that. I feel freer. I feel lighter. And hearing from others who haven't been able to kind of go there yet, they don't have to write a piece about it. They can share it with a friend or a family member. But hearing from them, I believe that I did the right thing, at least for me, because the thing that I'm most emotional about now is not my own experience. It's knowing how many of the people I love and care about and know are in, the kind of pain they're carrying around. Yeah. And that, I guess for me, that's where who I am as a journalist meets who I am and my experiences as a human, because it makes me very angry. And it really, watching Brett Kavanaugh for me and for a lot of us was kind of the embodiment of that injustice. And that's where I think, the real power in sharing our stories and power in numbers comes from.
Lauren?
I just wanted to speak to what Libs shared about her experience. There are very honorable, powerful reasons not to tell. I am not in any way ever going to diminish someone who feels unable to tell or who makes a choice not to tell. That it can be internal reasons, like Lib shared. It can be external reasons, like I might get taken away from my family or I might lose my job. But they are all very real. At the same time, one of the other things that Lib did not bring up is that we have more control over our own experiences and how we shape them and how we interpret them if they're solely ours and we don't have other people telling us how we should behave.
Sarah emailed, "I went to a small liberal arts college where sexual assault was rampant. One day I met up with a friend and he gave me some vodka, and I don't remember much else. My next memory was me face down, pants down, with my quote-unquote friend on top of me, still inside me. I never thought of him that way, never consented, and barely had the strength to get him off of me. When I tried to tell some people what happened, I was called a whore, lucky because my rapist was apparently attractive to others, and I was called a complainer. And people wonder why survivors don't come forward." Pat emailed, "When I was 13 years old, a podiatrist began molesting me. He was 31. He told my mom he had some work I could do for him as he checked patients in nursing homes. He took me to pornographic movie theaters. He taught me what a glory hole was. He had a friend of his implant an IUD in me. This went on for almost 2 years. Lauren, let me stick with you for just a moment. I would love to get your reaction to a clip from White House advisor Kellyanne Conway, who spoke this weekend about her own experiences with being assaulted. Listen.
I feel very empathetic, frankly, for victims of sexual assault and sexual harassment and rape. That I'm a victim of sexual assault. I don't expect Judge Kavanaugh or Jake Tapper or Jeff Flake or anybody to be held responsible for that. You have to be responsible for your own conduct.
That was Kellyanne Conway speaking to Jake Tapper on CNN. Lauren, what do you make of her comment?
Well, first of all, I'm glad she came out as a survivor. You could feel the emotion in her voice. It's a side of Kellyanne Conway we none of us have ever seen before. But she seems to put the blame entirely on herself, being responsible for your own conduct, when we know that the aggressor is the only person responsible for the harassment, abuse, or assault. You can wear anything you want. You can get as drunk as you want. If there is not a rapist there, you will not be raped. I'm sorry that she's carrying that, and it's a really common thing that a lot of people carry.
Carlos wrote on our Facebook page, I am a 50-year-old male survivor of sexual assault by a man who was my mother's boyfriend at the time. To this day, it is difficult for me to trust any man aside from my brothers. Because of this, I rarely hug anyone, and I'm extremely protective of my daughters. Professor Conan, could you react to that? I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of how this might be playing out differently for male survivors of trauma versus women who have been traumatized.
Thank you for bringing this up, because one of the things we haven't talked much about is that men are also victims of sexual abuse and assault, and that the effects on them of developing anxiety, phobia, PTSD are similar to that women experience after being assaulted. And I think for men who are victims of sexual assault, if it's possible there's more stigma, there's even more stigma in terms of being able to come out be heard. So in terms of how this is playing out, I wonder how men are feeling in terms of, do they feel, can they identify with Dr. Ford, or do they feel like their experiences are being neglected? I think if more men who were able to and felt comfortable speaking out, that actually would be really helpful to move the conversation. You mentioned earlier about men's involvement, and I think people have mentioned hearing from male perpetrators, but we also need to hear from male allies and males who've had similar experiences. I think that that would also help this movement advance.
Let me stick with you, Professor Conan. What about the nature of the reaction that someone gives you when you first share that story of sexual assault? I imagine that has a big impact on the way that you internalize it, process it, deal with it thereafter.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. It can have maybe the biggest impact. Survivors who share their stories and they're heard with support sort of allowed to speak as much as they want, give as much detail as they want, keep control over their story. Lauren mentioned, control, and that's really important. So listening and hearing and not pushing for details if the person doesn't want to give. They are much more likely to feel better and sort of recover more quickly than someone who's blamed or questioned or some people mentioned being ridiculed, laughed at, dismissed. Mm-hmm. That can be devastating, and it really reinforces the survivor's own probably tendency to blame herself and question her own actions. It's sort of normal after a trauma or an assault to question one's own actions, because if you look back at what you did and you look back, well, if I hadn't gotten drunk, that wouldn't have happened. If I hadn't done that, it can help you feel safe in the, going forward. You think, well, if I just don't do that again, I'll protect myself.
Right.
The sort of brain, that's how the brain works. It isn't the survivor's fault, but there's something adaptive in those moments of questioning your behavior. And if it's reinforced by someone you're speaking to or by the larger context, folks in the media, politicians, that really is devastating and can cause someone to, be silent for the rest of their lives and also not maybe get the help they might need or reach out to others who may be actually supportive.
We have gotten a number of voices from men whose lives have been affected by sexual assault. Ramel emailed, and Mara, I'd love to get your reaction to Ramel. Ramel emailed, when I was 14, I would regularly grope my stepsister. She would laugh and giggle, but also say no and stop. I now see how I was wrong, not just a boy being a boy. I want to apologize to my stepsister. We have a decent relationship, but it's never come up. How do I apologize without bringing up painful memories? Mara, what would you say to Ramel?
Wow. Well, first of all, I think it's incredibly brave to take responsibility. You have to, when you ask for forgiveness, you're asking for that person's forgiveness. You give them back the power that you took from them. And I think that whether or not he's forgiven is up to her. But I think that's a really important point because, we are all human. We all make mistakes, and some of us do, commit terrible wrongs on one another. I'm not a judge, but at the same time, I do think that there has to be room in this conversation and in this country for some redemption. But that only comes after a complete accounting of what you've done. And frankly, is in, I believe, should be in the hands of those who are wronged. Mm-hmm. And I think in the case before us with Brett Kavanaugh, there are lots of people who say, well, many 17-year-olds have made mistakes. Should they be paying for it for the rest of their lives? Some are, first of all, who are not as privileged as Brett Kavanaugh. And also, maybe not, but that doesn't entitle you to a seat on the Supreme Court. I do think that there has to be a room for where do we go from here, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't just vilify one another. But at the same time, there needs to be accountability.
Go ahead, Mar.
The power back.
Let me get to a few more comments before we're out of time. Marianne in St. Louis emailed, "My fear is that a confirmation for Kavanaugh will sanction this behavior not just for adult males, but for young men who are most probably more keyed into this story more than we acknowledge." And Lauren, I wonder if we could finish with one more quick email. Howard writes, "I have heard none of your speakers identify their abusers or attackers. The quantum leap Dr. Ford took is to have identified her attacker. I regret that none of your listeners has followed her lead to that degree, although, of course, I honor the level of disclosure each victim chooses." Lauren, before we have to go, what about naming your attacker, perhaps naming and shaming your attacker? How do you view the impact of that?
I think every person needs to do what's best for them. In my case, I don't know who it was, so there's no point. I really think, it's all about violation, whatever form it takes, is all about having your power taken away from you. So whatever way you can reclaim your power, I'm not going to judge. And if that means naming, that's great. And if that means not naming, that's also great. I do think that what Mara was talking about holding someone accountable, you need to name someone in order to hold someone accountable. And that not just in on the individual level, but on the societal level, and start looking at ways that we can hold people accountable without locking them up.
Lauren Taylor, founder and director of Defend Yourself, an organization that teaches sexual violence prevention. Lauren, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Mara Gay, who's on the New York Times editorial board. Mara, thank you.
Thank you.
And Professor Kerestin Conan, who teaches psychiatric epidemiology at Harvard. Professor Conan, thanks very much.
Thanks for covering this.
One more time, the number for the National Sexual Assault Hotline, 800-656-4673, 800-656-4673. This show was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. We are honored that you shared your stories and your questions with us. Thank you for being so honest and so vulnerable. And as always, thanks for listening. This is 1A.